Thank you very much. Just actually, I'm at Collège de France. I've been for 10 years. Sorry. Okay, so let me see if I manage to use that. So first, I'm very pleased to be here, very honored also. My first talk will be using this slide. Tomorrow and the day after tomorrow, I plan really to prove some results, at least to give some hints of some proofs of the results, so I will use blackboard and chalk. Okay, the theme of this lecture is not quite in the program, enfin, close to the program on hominimal structures, but you will see at the end of the lecture the word subalgebraic at some point. But it really belongs more to dynamical systems theory. So the first part of the lecture will be really to explain more or less the context of the results, which were obtained jointly with Arthur Avila and Jairo Bocchi. And the second part will be to present the results themselves, and tomorrow to give more details. Tomorrow and the day after tomorrow. So first, what is a co-cycle? A linear co-cycle. Co-cycle is a very ubiquitous word in mathematics. In my context, and the context of this lecture, we will have a compact space, compact metric space X, an homeomorphism F on X, and then a vector bundle on X, and the co-cycle itself is just a vector bundle map F over small f, and so it means that we have for each X a linear map Fx from E in the XX to EFX, which is linear, so and depends continuously on X. So just a general vector bundle map. And in the dynamical system ideology, say, you want to iterate this map and to look how it behaves. Now let me see that. Okay. This one. I will always assume that the map is invertible, but you could do something in the non-invertible case, just to make things simple. Actually, the precise context of the result will be much more specific than that, but the general context is this one. And obviously, we have a specific there is a very specific example in mind, which comes from, which if you start with a manifold and the diffeomorphism of the manifold, then you use as a vector bundle the tangent bundle, as the bundle map is a tangent map, and this is the example from which the theory has evolved. But the point, there is a slight change of point of view, is that here, obviously, in this example, the map, the properties of F are closely related to the property of F itself. Indeed, what we will do is to assume in this context the opposite, is that we assume that the property of the Bayes dynamics, the properties of F, are well understood, and we will really study from these well understood properties the property of the co-cycle depending of the bundle map F. So in a sense, the point of view is slightly different between this basic example and the general one that we will consider. Okay. The notion, so the word that appear in the title were uniformly hyperbolic. So what means uniformly hyperbolic? So you have here the definition, at least the start of the definition. So you have a linear cocycle and a vector bundle E. You say that this vector bundle, this bundle map is uniformly hyperbolic if you can find the splitting. This splitting is supposed to be first continuous, so the decompositions of the fiber EX into two subspaces ESX and EUX is continuous in X, and also F invariant, which means that the bundle map, the linear map FX sends ESX to ES small f, F of X, and the same for EU. And moreover, the ES is called the stable subbundle because if you look at the norm of F to the N for positive N restricted to ES, then this map will decrease, the norm of the map will decrease exponentially fast in a uniform way. So there exist constants C and lambda like that, for which you have this estimate. And the same is true in EU, but in negative time, looking at the past dynamics for f, so f minus 1 here, you look the same contraction in the past. Okay, so this is the definition of uniformly hyperbolic dynamics. Fine, co-cycle. And just some side remark is that when it is uniformly hyperbolic, you can actually get rid of this constant C, so you get something really uniform in this sense, but you have to change norms to take some equivalent norm for which then this inequality holds with C equals 1. Okay, now this is the definition, but actually in, if you have in a practical way some concrete linear cocycle and you want to prove that it is uniformly hyperbolic, in general you don't apply the definition. You use the following criterion, which is the so-called Kohn-Field criterion, which is more useful in a sense than the definition, which is equivalent to the definition. So starting with a linear cocycle, you will have a splitting, but this time the splitting is not assumed to be invariant. The splitting E between E1 and E2, it's not also not assumed to be continuous, not assumed to be invariant, but it comes with two norms, one on each of the sum bundle, and this, so these norms should satisfy the following, so writing things like that. They should satisfy first that the norms which appear here are equivalent in a uniform way to the initial norm, so this is a mild condition, and then the important condition really are the following two. I will have a picture in the next slide, but first, so assume that you have a vector. So you should think as E2 as some kind of approximation of the unstable subbundle, and E1 as some approximation to the stable one. So you are guessing more or less in which direction is the stable subbundle, and guessing in which direction, approximate direction, is the unstable one. So assuming that you have a vector V, which is V1 plus V2, which is rather in the unstable direction because the second component is larger than the first one, then what you say is that first it's even more in the unstable condition, so because this constant lambda here is larger than 1, so it's even closer to the unstable, to the second direction E2, and also this second component is getting bigger, okay? And there is a symmetric condition, which is going in the past, so now you start with the second vector and going backwards, then it's more in the stable direction, E1, then the image, the pre-image B here will be more in the first component, in the first direction E1, and it will be greater in this direction. So I just mentioned already that the splitting is neither F-invariant nor continuous, and also that these conditions are obviously open. If you change the cocycle F by a small C0 perturbation, then the property will be still preserved. You have perhaps to change slightly lambda, still being larger than 1, but changing very slightly lambda, you will preserve this condition, which are obviously open. So uniform hyperbolicity is an open property. Now, so this is the definition. Now, the picture is the following. So explaining that now that with the picture, the splitting, it's perhaps too small to read, but the horizontal direction is the E2 direction, the vertical direction is the E1. Here we are at X, here we are at f of x, so the map fx sends this space to this one, okay? So the cones are, these are the lines where the norms are equal, okay, corresponding to this. So if you start with a vector V, where the second component here, corresponding to this case, the second component being larger than the first one, so in this part of the cone here, then the image W is in this smaller cone, here, corresponding to this lambda here, and the length of the first component is larger by a factor lambda than the length here. And the same is true in backward time. If you start with a W prime now, which is in this cone here, corresponding to this property, coming backwards here, the image is in the smaller cone, corresponding to this lambda here. And also the length, vertical length now here is larger by a factor lambda of the length here. Okay? So it's kind of complicated to read, but I guess that the geometric intuition behind this property is pretty clear. Okay? So stable means that it's contracted in the past, but it means also that from a projective point of view, the stable direction is attracting, is repelling. So it's kind of the unstable direction is attracting from the projective point of view. In the future, the vectors tend to approach the unstable direction. So this is the way that the formula here gives the way that the stable and unstable subspace are obtained from this decomposition. You go in a long way in the future for the stable one. So you take the E1 direction at Fn of x and go back by f to the minus n at x. And you get something which tends to ESS as n goes to infinity, and you exchange the past and future for EU. Okay. Now, this is the definition of uniform hyperbolicity, but you probably have heard about another concept which is related to hyperbolicity, not uniform hyperbolicity, but still hyperbolicity, which is the notion of a Lyapunov exponent. So the context for Lyapunov exponent is slightly different. For Lyapunov exponent, you start still with the linear cocycle, but you need also some invariant measure. It's not a purely topological concept. So you start with also some invariant measure, and it's easier to state the Osseledet theorem that will appear on the slide. It's easier to assume that the measure is ergodic, meaning that every invariant set has measure 0 or 1 with respect to mu. Actually, every F invariant measure can be decomposed in ergodic invariant measure, so it's not really a restriction to assume that it is ergodic. It's only a simplification for the statement. Okay, so assuming that, then you have this the celebrated Osseledet's multiplicative ergodic theorem, which is from the end of the 60s, which says that you will find, for any linear cocycle, any F-invariant ergodic measure, some numbers, lambda 1 to lambda r, at least r is at least 1, which are associated to the cocycle in the following way. You have a splitting. So now this splitting is definitely not continuous. It is F-invariant, meaning that E1x will be sent to E1 f of x by f. But it's not continuous in general. I mean, it can be in some examples, but in general, it's definitely not continuous, only measurable. And then the property of EEx is that if you take a non-zero vector V in this subspace, then and you iterate the cocycle from this vector V, and then the norm, the rate of exponential growth of the norm, both in the future and in the past, is given by lambda I if you start with a vector V in the subspace EI, non-zero vector. Okay, so what you see, obviously, is that if you start with what is the relation between Lyapunov exponent and uniform hyperbolicity? If you start with a uniformly hyperbolic linear cocycle, then, I need to use that, then the Lyapunov exponent will be, not only will be non-zero, they will increase, but in the direction, the vector V which sits in the stable subspace will decrease exponentially fast, so the corresponding Lyapunov exponent should be negative, and the vector in the EU direction should decrease exponentially in the past, meaning that they will increase exponentially in the future time, and so the corresponding Lyapunov exponents are strictly positive. So the Lyapunov exponent should be bounded away from zero, and this uniformly for any F-invariant ergodic measure. So this is one implication. Actually, there is only this one, because the converse is not true. So the uniform hyperbolicity, as defined it in the beginning of the talk, is a notion that is strictly stronger than the fact that the Lyapunov exponents are non-zero. So I've mentioned Lyapunov exponents that they actually will not appear in the following. It's only because they are much used, and it's a very important notion of hyperbolicity. But I will really use the other notion, which is stronger. Okay, now, so I'm getting more specific and getting really to the subject of the result that I want to mention later. I will only look at not any cocycle, but SL2R cocycle in the title. So it means that just I will be in dimension 2, the dimension of the fiber. Not only the dimension of the fiber, but I will have really some trivial vector bundle. It's really not an hypothesis, because in one moment the basis X will be some totally disconnected space. So any bundle is trivial. There is no topology in the base. The bundle will just be X cross R2. And also I will assume that the determinant of the matrices. So now, because the bundle is trivial, the bundle map is just given by a matrix A which is depends on the base point X, and which depends in this on a continuous way. And I'm assuming that the matrix here has determinant 1. So anyway, if the determinant is not 1, you can take the determinant out, and it's just a one-dimensional object that it is easy to consider. So, but still, I'm assuming that the determinant is 1 here. It's an hypothesis. And so it means that if you are iterating, just to get used to what happens, when you iterate this cocycle, what I get after n iteration is a matrix n of x here. Here, on the base, obviously, I'm just iterating the dynamics on the base. But on the fiber, I have a dynamic which is given by a matrix, which is just a product, as you see, a product of 2 by 2 matrices, A of X till A of Fn minus 1 of X. This is for positive N. And for negative N, you have a similar formula using the inverses. Okay. I'm still getting more specific because I want to know what will be the dynamics on the base. Now, there have been a huge amount of work with a dynamic, there is something that I want to say before. In the case of SL2R cocycles, there is a very easy way to check whether the cocycle is uniformly hyperbolic. It's something which is specific for SL2R. Cocycles, it's not true in higher dimension, for instance. But in this case, it's just sufficient to check that the matrices, the products that we have just seen, these products are going growing exponentially fast. So if you check that the norms of these products is growing exponentially fast, then actually it's sufficient for. This is obviously always a necessary condition for uniform hyperbolicity. So as a necessary condition, this is obvious in a general context, but that the condition is also sufficient to check uniform hyperbolicity is completely specific of the SL2R case, it's actually a very easy, concrete condition to check. Not necessarily easy. You have to try to estimate the norm of this product, but still it's very concrete. Okay, now, coming back to the sentence that I begin, what has been studied a lot is cocycles, SL2R cocycles, over some quasi-periodic dynamics in the base. Quasi-periodic dynamics here means something very specific. It means that the base is a torus, And the homeomorphism small f, the f that we iterate in the base, is just a translation on this torus, say a minimal translation, a translation by some irrational alpha here. If it's not irrational, actually the dynamics leave some sub-torus invariant and you can restrict to some sub-torus. So it's not really a strong restriction to assume that this alpha is irrational. So assuming that you have some ergodic minimal translation on this torus TD, so you have a matrix A depending on this X and you are making this product. And this is actually important also in a mathematical physics context because it has a lot of relation with the so-called one-dimensional discrete Schrödinger operator. So there is a, some accent that is missed. So these Schrödinger operators with quasi-periodic potentials. So let me just explain that in a very short way. I'm not doing really in this direction, but it has been a very important subject of research. So you start with a potential V here, some potential on the torus TD, which is typically a smooth potential, typically analytic or if say infinity or something like that, very smooth potential V. And then you define from this an operator on the space of square summable sequences, L2 of Z, by this formula. Two-step recursive formula, involving the un plus 1, un minus 1, and un. So you can think of this, you see this is one 1D discrete, because if you take out a minus 2 here, you have a second difference, un plus 1 plus un minus 1, minus 2 un, which is the second derivative in the discrete sense, and then the potential v plus 2 here. So it's really strongly related to the classical Schrödinger operator. And the relation between this operator and the cocycle, the SL2R cocycle, is the following. If you have some eigenvector of this operator U with eigenvalue lambda, so it's completely trivial to check that this formula is equivalent, so saying that U is an eigenvector, so HU is lambda U, to this formula here, where A is this matrix here. Okay? So this is a concrete SL2R matrix depending on the potential V here. Now, a number of people have proved is that there are strong relations between the spectral properties of the one-parameter family of operator H here. Well, this is the one-parameter family because it depends on theta. I'm thinking of V and alpha, the potential and the rotation on the base, as being fixed. And then I have still to choose a phase theta here, the phase theta which appears here. So this is a one-dimensional, one-parameter family operator. And on the other side, still keeping alpha fixed, I have a one-parameter family of cocycle, where the parameter now is the eigenvalue parameter lambda here. This is a cocycle, SL2R cocycle, on the base. The base here is the translation theta plus alpha. And so these relations, they are much more subtle than that, but at the uniform hyperbolic level, the relation is the following. It's very easy. It's just that first, the spectrum of this operator is actually independent of the phase parameter theta, so it does not depend on theta. And actually, a number lambda belongs to the spectrum, if and only if the cocycle defined by this A lambda V is uniformly hyperbolic. So here it's a very kind of simple relation. Then afterwards, when you want to study the spectral property in more details, look at the property of spectral measure or things like that, then you have more equivalence like that, but at a much more subtle level. But at a very elementary level, you see that to determine the spectrum is equivalent to determine whether this is uniformly hyperbolic or not. So it's a very natural and important question. Okay. Sorry, yeah. Well. Now, so what I will do is actually look at the kind of opposite case. So I was just talking about this quasi-periodic co-cycles where the basis is this translation on a torus. So this is a kind of quasi-periodic dynamics which has some kind of standard properties. At the complete opposite of the spectrum of dynamical properties, there is the so-called very chaotic properties, and there are several models for these chaotic properties. And the one that I will choose, so I will look at a linear co-cycle where the basis is not at all quasi-periodic, but completely the opposite. It's really very chaotic. And the one that I will look at really are the following. The so-called full shift on a finite alphabet. So A is just a finite alphabet on some number of letters, at least two. And then I'm looking at sequences indexed by the integers. And the dynamics on this space of sequences is just a shift map. The shift map, it just takes the sequence and translates it one step to the left, like the formula which is here. Okay, so this will be my dynamics for the basis. Actually, this or a slight generalization. The slight generalization is the following. It's a so-called full shift on n symbols, where instead of allowing all sequences here, you are only allowing sequences where the letter that you can write after a given letter only depends on the letter you have just written. So you have some transitions which are allowed. You can describe the set of possible transitions by a graph gamma. So this is said by this sentence. You are looking at exactly the sentences where any consecutive pair of letters appears as an arrow, as an edge of gamma. Okay? So but actually, if you prefer, if you are not used to this subshift of finite type, just forget it. Forget about this, just consider this case. Because actually, it will appear, especially tomorrow and the day after tomorrow, that we know more, actually, the results are more precise in this case, the case of the full shift, the so-called full shift here, than in the general case of shifts of finite type. So, if you are not familiar with subshift of finite type, just concentrate on this case of full shift, so all possible sequences. Now, so this is for the dynamics on the base. I will make one more restriction, and finally we will have exactly the kind of object that we want to look at. The restriction is that I have still a matrix which belongs to SL2R, and this matrix should depend only on the letter in position zero. So I have a sequence, an infinite sequence of letters. So I'm just looking, and the dependence on the sequence, the matrix is supposed to depend on the sequence, and the dependence is only through the letter in position zero. It means that the parameter space is very simple. Well, the parameter space is finite dimensional. Okay? You have just to give a linear co-cycle satisfying all these properties. You just have to give a finite number, n actually, matrices in SL2R. So this is the parameter space for all linear co-cycles that I will look at. And so if you are looking at the case of the full shift, which is here, what you want to look at is whether the product of this matrix. So you are starting with n matrices, say n equals to 3, A1, A2, ABC, simpler, assume n equals to 3. So what you are looking at is really 3 matrices, A, B, C, and what you are allowed, for instance, in this case, is to make all possible products, which correspond to all possible sequences, all possible products of A, B, C, but not the inverses. A, B, C, so A, B, B, A, C, C, B, any product like that is allowed. And the condition for uniform hyperbolicity now is that this product should grow uniformly fast in a uniform way in terms of the length of the product. Okay, if it grows uniformly fast, then it will be uniformly hyperbolic. If it doesn't grow uniformly fast, it is not uniformly hyperbolic. So it's a simple condition. In the other case, well, in the other case, you have a restriction of the kind of projection that you are looking at. For instance, the restriction could be, if you think of the graph here, the restriction could be, I cannot write a B after A, for instance. Okay? So you are still any product, except that at no point you have, you can write A followed by B. This could be one of the restrictions, but it could be many more, but this kind of restriction. Okay? So, what I want to look at, it's a very natural question, is just to describe, in this context, the hyperbolicity locus, which is, so the set H, which is here, the hyperbolicity locus is in the title of the slide, is this set H, so it's a subset of this very nice manifold here, which is formed of the parameters for which the cocycle is uniformly hyperbolic. So it's a completely well-defined open set. I have explained at the beginning that uniform hyperbolicity is something which is open with respect to changing the cocycle, so changing parameters here. So it's an open set. And what means to describe an open set? Well, there are two kinds of questions, and there will be two kinds of answers. To understand this set, we will see, is not connected. So we would like to understand the connected components and also to understand the boundary. So it means that the topology would be another question also, but it's... okay, so as I mentioned at the beginning, now that I'm coming to the specific setting that we are studying, the results were obtained in collaboration with Artur Avila and Jair Obocki. Okay, so before I state the first result, let me introduce the definition. So first, I want to rephrase the cone criterion. You remember that I gave the definition of uniform hyperbolicity, I explained that it was easier to check when you have a concrete cocycle to check uniform hyperbolicity from this cone field criterion. And so I want to rephrase in the context of SL2R cocycle what means the cone field criterion. So it means that first, I will look actually in the following, not on the dynamics on the base which is this sigma, this space of sequences, subshift of any type or full shift, so this is the base, but on the fiber I won't look at R2 but rather at the projective action. So I've really a map on the product of sigma cross one dimensional projective space, just a circle. So the fiber is a circle. And then, so the cone, itself is defining an interval, an interval that is called IX here. And so the cone field criterion is exactly that there exists an interval IX depending on X, and which is sent in a compactly, so the image of IX by the matrix. So the matrix that I want to use is the matrix at the point X, which depends, as I explained, only on the value of the sequence at space zero. So it's this matrix here. So the image here, so the image of the cone, should be inside the cone at the image point. Okay, exactly the picture that I gave before, using just that cones in two-dimensional space at the projective levels are just intervals. Okay, but just only that. And the fact that the uniformity that I had in the cone field criterion, the fact that the constant lambda which was appearing, the constant lambda was uniform with respect to X, is the fact that the distances now between the four points, which are the boundary points of this interval, the boundary points of this other interval, that these four points are not close to each other. The distance are bounded from below. Okay, now this is the Cornfield criterion revisited, but what I want actually is to give in the following a simpler version of this. Simpler in the sense that I would like to get rid of the dependence on X. Now this is not completely possible. Actually there is a price to pay. And the price to pay is to use a slightly more complicated notion, is the notion of multicone. So what is a multicone in this context? It's just not one interval, but a finite number of intervals, of disjoint intervals, so it's formally speaking a non-empty open subset in P1, which has finitely many connected components, and I want that their closure is disjoint. So the complement has also, is also the union of finitely many non-trivial intervals. Okay, so this is a multicone, and so now for the first result. So the first result, it's easier to state, enfin, it's easier to formulate the result in the case of full shift. So again, if you don't like shifts or subshifts of finite type, you will forget the second part of the slide. But in the case of full shift, so the result with Arthur and Jairo Bocchi, is the following. So the cocycle is uniformly hyperbolic if and only if there exists a multicone, so in this context, you find it union of interval, but the point is that does not depend on X. You have killed, there is no more dependence on X, such that every matrix A alpha, so there are a finite number, recall that the cocycle now is just given by a finite number of matrices, and for each of these matrices, the image of M by A alpha is strictly contained in M. Okay? Very so, simple thing to check. And in the general case, it's slightly more complicated because you don't get the same multicone, but you get one which only depends again on the letter in position zero. So again, you have now a finite number of multicone, M alpha, and now you ask that this property, that the image of M alpha by A beta should be contained in M beta, this for allowed every allowed transition from alpha to beta. So it's slightly more complicated. Just, I mean, I want to mention this result, but really it's probably much better for you to concentrate on this simpler statement. And anyway, again, we have much more results on this full shift case than in the general subshift case. Yeah, okay, sorry, I will keep that up there here. Okay, so this was the first result. Now, what is the use of multicones? So we will use multicones to analyze in particular what are the connected components of the hyperbolicity locus. Because you can use multicones to get some combinatorial invariants for the connected components. So, more precisely, the multicones here are obviously not unique. Again, because these properties are open, if I have some M which satisfies this property, I certainly can move slightly the boundary points of the components of M, and if I'm moving them little enough, the property here will still be satisfied. So, obviously, M is not unique, but I would like some kind of uniqueness, and for even for this, I need to make some restriction of the multicone which appears here, and this is the notion of tightness in the title here. So I will concentrate on this case, so forget about this one. So I have just one multicone, and I will say that the multicone M is tight if the following is satisfied. First, I introduce the dual multicone, which is kind of trivial duality here, just taking the complementary, because I have assumed that multicones were open, I have to take the closure of M and then the complement of the closure, and I get another multicone, which is called the dual multicone M prime, with the same number of components. And obviously also, this property for A alpha, if I'm going to the inverse, switching time, so replacing the left, the subshift was subshift translating one to the left by translating one to the right, if you prefer, so kind of trivial operation, then I will get the same properties, but this time with the dual multicone. So I mean the dual property. And so the multicone M is tight if, in a sense, it has not too many components. And it means the following, that any component of M will intersect, will contain actually some component of some A alpha of M. So this union here, which is contained, so recall that I had A alpha of M contained in M for all alpha. So this union here is certainly contained in M. And what I'm asking here for tightness is that I need every component of M to cover this set. There is no component of M which does not intersect this set here. And the dual property for the dual multicone here. Okay, so this is the definition of tightness. And actually, it's not difficult, it's a small exercise to check that tightness is the same that to ask that among invariant multicone, invariant means this property here. If this among multicone which satisfies this property here, I'm looking for multicone with the smallest possible number of components. So the usual cones correspond to one component, and then I can have more than one. But recall that multicone have already a finite number of components. So now that I have this tight multicones, I can look at the number of components and also the way that they are interchanged by the various A alpha, because each A alpha M is sending this multicone inside itself, they will be permuted in some complicated way. We will see an example in a moment, but at the moment just a principle that I will use the existence of such multicones and that property of the tight multicones, the one which smallest possible number of components, to get some invariance. Okay, so now this is a definition that you certainly know, so I'm just recalling the definition about hyperbolic versus elliptic versus parabolic 2x2 matrices. And also some trivial remark, but which is necessary for the following. The remark is that, I've talked in the last transparent, I was talking about actually the dynamics on the projective space. So it even does not depend on if I'm changing each A alpha by some sign, I will not change its dynamics. And obviously, the fact that it is increasing in norms or not does not depend on the sign. So the hyperbolicity locus is invariant by the action of this over 2z to the n, which is multiplying each of the parameters by some sign. Okay? So this is a kind of trivial operation. And so it means that I already can see a number of components, but they are not the most interesting, but they are the most obvious ones, which are the so-called principal components. If I start with the matrix A, which is hyperbolic, I can take all the parameters, the A alpha equal to A. If I'm taking every A alpha equal to A, then the products that we get are just the powers of A, and the powers of hyperbolic matrix grow exponentially fast. So this kind of parameter is always uniformly hyperbolic. Okay? So these are the obvious uniformly hyperbolic parameters. And so the connected component of the hyperbolicity locus which contains this obvious uniformly hyperbolic parameter, this component which we call the principal component. Obviously, if there were only principal components, the situation would not be very interesting. Okay? The point is that it's not true. Fortunately for this talk, there are many other components which are less, much less obvious. And so, first, principal components. How can you recognize the principal component? Well, actually, they are exactly the one for which the multicone, the tight multicone, is just an ordinary cone. This is this proposition that actually was obtained before the joint work with Avila and Bohi, which in a sense motivated what we did after that. That So in one direction, it's completely trivial. It's not difficult in the other direction too, but in one direction, it's completely trivial. If the parameter is in the same component than the trivial one which are here, this one, then the multicone has to be ordinary cone with only one component. The point is that there is a deformation of the multicone, and the deformation will not change the number of components. Okay, so the one direction is obvious, and the other direction you have to prove actually that if you have only one component in the multicone, then you are actually connected by some path, explicit path, to this kind of parameter. So this, you need some work, but it's not difficult. Okay. Now it happens that to get more deeply in the matter, the situation is rather well understood when you have only two matrices for the full shift on two symbols. And this will be essentially the theme of my talk tomorrow. Tomorrow I plan to explain in much more detail than now what happened in this specific case on the full shift of two symbols. So taking two matrices A and B and making any product that you want of A and B and looking when it is hyperbolic. In this case, we understand really well the situation. And let me just give some taste of the situation. So just introducing some notation before stating the result. So I'm start with AB, which is a uniformly hyperbolic cocycle. So it sits in the hyperbolicity locus, H. And then I'm looking at Q, the number of components of the tight some tight invariant multicone attached to AB. Okay? And P is the number of components of M which intersect this B of M. Okay? So, I'm assuming that I'm not in the principal case, this one, and because of this proposition, so I'm assuming that there are at least two components in M. Okay? Q is larger than one. Now the result that we obtain with Artur and Jairo is the following. First, we have this P is strictly contained between 0 and Q, and P is prime to Q. So actually you can describe this parameter P and Q as a rational between 0 and 1, P over Q. A component will intersect A of M, so the other matrices, the matrices are A and B, if and only if it does not intersect B. And on the other side, this is for the description in this direction. Conversely, if you are given any rational, so for any P over Q, you will get exactly 8 non-principal components of H with this data. Why 8? You can see already 4 of them. Remember, there were this change of sign. If when I have some AB parameter, I can change the sign of A, change of the sign of B, and this will give you 4 components for free if you have one of them. Okay? Actually, there is still one other operation that preserves hyperbolicity and will give you the 8 component is the conjugacy by some element of determinant minus 1. So changing the orientation of P1. Changing of orientation of P1 will give you, so conjugating by this change of orientation will give you the 8 component. So it's really one if you prefer. There is one true new component for every P over Q, but it's still a large number of components, one for each rational between 0 and 1. So I will describe more precisely perhaps these components tomorrow, but here, sorry, I will first perhaps save this transparent here. And then here is the one which corresponds to 2/5, just to give some examples, okay? So 2/5 means what? It means first that there is the 5 here, means there is 5 components, The five components of the multicones are these five intervals that you see here. And the arrows here indicate the full arrows are for A, and the point, the dotted arrows for B. And they explain how these components are sensed into each other. Okay? So the two components on the top are the ones which are meeting the image of B. Okay, so for instance, this one is the image of this one, and this one is the image of the other four. This four here by B goes to this one. So this is for the B map, and the A map, the image are these three bottom components here, where this map is receiving this one, this is receiving this one, and this is receiving the other three here. And actually, for every rational P over Q, between 0 and 1, you can draw such a picture. Obviously, the picture will become complicated if you take a complicated rational. But here, this is a, this is really giving the complete description, I would say, rather complete description of the hypermulticity locus in the case of the shift of two symbols. So, it's a fact that the situation is, sorry, I will perhaps pass this here. And it's a fact that the situation is rather different from for the full shift of three or more symbols, or general subshift of any type, than the full shift of two symbols, which is a rather special case. Well, let me explain. So I'm giving another general result that will be more the subject of the third talk here on Wednesday. So, introducing the notion of heteroclinic connection. So, I'm starting with a parameter A, which defines a cocycle. And then, when A is hyperbolic, then every periodic point corresponds to some matrix, which is the product along the cycle of the matrix which come into the cycle, and this matrix has to be hyperbolic, because the power of this matrix has to grow exponentially fast. It implies that this matrix has to be hyperbolic. So this but on the other hand, the converse is not true. So there is some obstruction which is described here. So starting with some hyperbolic matrix, so this is just a notation, I will call S of A the stable direction, U of A the unstable direction. These are points in P1. Now, another definition is that for subshift or full shift, what is called the stable set is the set of Z which have the same future, the same components, the same letters, in the non-negative entries here, and the unstable one is the one which has the same entries, but now for the negative entries. Okay? So just a simple definition. And so now the last definition, what is the heteroclinic connection? It's some obstruction to be uniformly hyperbolic, but slightly subtle obstruction. This is the following. So I take X and Y, two periodic points in sigma. It just means two periodic sequence of letters, the sequence where the letter repeats itself with some periodicity. The periods are K and L. And I'm assuming that the corresponding products here are hyperbolic. Okay? Now, what I call an heteroclinic connection is really a point Z. So the point Z should coincide with X in the past, it should coincide with Y at beyond stage N. So this means that. So it means that the coordinates of Z beyond step N are the same as for Y. So in a sense, the point Z here has only N free coordinates, the one between 0 and N, N minus 1 actually. Okay? So, and now what you want is have this relation. So these are directions. So this is the stable direction of this hyperbolic matrix. This is the unstable direction of this other hyperbolic matrix. And this matrix here, which is just this finite product depending on the free coordinates in Z, is sending this direction and this one. Okay? So why is this an obstruction for uniform hypermolicity? Because if you look at this vector here, this vector is stable. So it means that in the future, it will go to as a norm. The norm of this vector will go to zero exponentially fast. Huh? For this point z, because the point z coincides with y starting with n. If you go in the past, then in the past, first it will be bring back to this vector here, and then in the past, because this is unstable, it will go down also exponentially fast. So this heteroclinic connection thing means that you have some vector which in the future is going to zero exponentially fast, and in the past is also going to zero exponentially fast. And this cannot happen in a uniformly hyperbolic context. In a uniformly hyperbolic context, you have a non-zero vector as a non-zero component, either in the stable direction or the unstable direction. It's a splitting. Okay, and so in both cases, there will be, it will go to infinity, actually go to infinity exponentially fast, either in the future or in the past or both. But certainly cannot go both to zero in the past and in the future. So this heteroclinic connection is an obstruction for uniform hypermolicity, and we have a result which says that if you are looking at a parameter on the boundary of subcomponent, so I'm looking for an obstruction, I'm now trying to describe the boundary of the hyperbolicity locus. What can happen when you go along a path, say, you were uniformly hyperbolic, and you will lose some uniform hyperbolicity. So what happens is that the obvious obstruction is the following. As a matrix, there is some periodic orbit, or periodic point, such that the corresponding matrix was hyperbolic when the parameter was uniformly hyperbolic. It has to be certainly, this matrix has to be hyperbolic, and then this matrix became parabolic. So the trace is 2 or minus 2. If, for instance, if you have just two matrices, you start with AB, AB have to be hyperbolic, and for instance, A becomes parabolic. This is obviously a possibility. So this is the obvious possibility, and the non-obvious one, which is the second one, which is this heteroclitic connection. Okay? So I've just explained that this is actually an obstruction for uniform hypermolicity, and so it can happen that on the boundary you will get some heteroclinic connection. So that's the point of the theorem, and on the boundary you always have one of these two. They are the only two possible things that can happen on the boundary. And now there is something more, is that the integer which come here, the m, k, l, n, which come here, actually bounded. Bounded in terms of what? Bounded in terms of the component. Look, I will come to open problems of the next transparent, but the open problems, we'll see there is a problem, an issue, whether the boundary of the hyperbolicity locus is actually the union of the boundary of its components. It's not known. It's an open question. So it's the reason that why it was formulated here in a rather, precise way. The parameter is not only on the boundary of the hyperbolicity locus, but it is explicitly on the boundary of some component of the hyperbolicity locus. So with this thing, hypothesis, then the integers are really bounded in terms of the components which appear here. And as a corollary, so I promise that the word semi-algebraic, would appear here. And actually, what happens is that both the component H and the boundary of H are actually semi-algebraic. But it's not true that H itself, for instance, is semi-algebraic because, for instance, H has infinitely many components. Just not true that it is. And the point is that this integer which were bounded here, which allow to define the boundary and the H itself in terms of finitely many relations, if you allow the components to vary, then these integers are no more bounded and this gives an infinite number of relations. Okay, so to conclude the talk, this presentation, I would perhaps keep this one on this. So, a number of open questions. The questions actually are always open in the case of, say, the full shift of three or more symbols. We can answer the question, all the questions, in the case of the full shift of two symbols, but there are obvious differences, so they are really questions. I mean, it's not a question of not having a proof, it's really a question of perhaps the answer is different. For instance, are the boundary of the connected components of H disjoint? This is definitely true, we can prove it in the case of the full shift of two symbols. We don't know whether it's true of in the general case. A related question that I have mentioned more or less in the statement of this theorem is the question whether the boundary of H is equal to the union of the boundary of its components. What happens is that we will see that I guess on Wednesday. Well, tomorrow I will prove, I will indicate perhaps more or less a proof that in the case of the full shift of two symbols, a compact set in parameter space is meeting only finitely many components. So this certainly guarantees this property here. So again, this is true for the full shift over two symbols. On the other hand, which is this statement that a compact set is meeting only finitely many connected components of the hyperbolicity locus, this statement is just false. We will see that on Wednesday. It's perfectly possible that components can accumulate, a sequence of distinct components can accumulate some other component for the full shift on three symbols. So this is really a different phenomena which occur with three or more matrices, which does not occur for two matrices. But we know of an example where the components accumulate on some other components. So in this case, it does not give a counterexample to this statement. To have an example where the components are accumulating nowhere, in a sense, accumulating somewhere, but not at another component, which would give a counterexample to this one, we don't know. Okay, another direction for question, say, is about the ellipticity locus. I've talked about the hyperbolicity locus. The ellipticity locus is not really defined in the same way because this is the set of parameters for which, as I define, you are seeing some ellipticity. Uniformly hyperbolic means hyperbolicity everywhere. I mean, every product has to be hyperbolic. Here it's not the same, it's just some product is elliptic. So it's obviously something which is an obstruction to being hyperbolic. So it's an open set because elliptic matrices in SL2R form elliptic subset. So having some product which is elliptic, so it stays elliptic under perturbation. So it's open and it's obviously disjoint because iterates of this elliptic product stay bounded. So do not grow exponentially fast. So you have some elliptic, open set which is disjoint from H. Actually, it's a very, it's as big as it can be in this sense. You have a theorem by Avila, which says that the closure of E is actually dense in the complement of H. In the closure of the complement of H, the closure of E is equal to the component of H. It's still not known whether we have this opposite relation. In other terms, once you have that, and this is the theorem, if you have that, to have also that is equivalent to say that E and H, the hyperbolicity locus and the elliptic locus, are just the two sides of their common boundary. And you should have some common boundary, which is the complement of the union here, and then you have just the two sides. So this is one part of this assertion, and you would like to have this part, and this is not known. This is not known, again, except in the case of the full shift of two symbols, where you have indeed this property here. So you have a clean picture for the hyperbolicity and ellipticity locus in this case. And the last slide is the last question also, is about whether these components are bounded. Alors, bounded, they cannot be bounded in a trivial sense, because obviously uniform hyperbolicity is invariant under conjugacy. If you conjugate all matrices by some fixed matrix, then it will still be uniformly hyperbolic. And so, if the matrix you conjugate with is very large, you will get something very large. And so, every component is unbounded in a trivial sense. But you can ask in a non-trivial unbounded, enfin, boundedness or not, this is the notion of bounded mode conjugacy. You are saying that the subset in the parameter space is unbounded, enfin, is bounded mode conjugacy, if you can find a compact set K such that H is contained in the conjugate of K. And this is bounded mode conjugacy. And then the question is whether any component of H is unbounded mode conjugacy. Again, as you guess, the answer, we know the answer for the case of the full shift over two symbols, but we don't know the answer for more general full shifts over three or more symbols or for subshifts of finite type. Okay, so I will probably discuss, there are several variants for this question. So, okay, this was the last slide. As I explained, tomorrow I plan to spend the full lecture to describe the situation for the full shift over two symbols, where we really can describe all the components, and in particular showing that they have disjoint closures and they are going to infinity. A compact set will meet only a finite number of components, and actually they can be described one from each other. We'll describe the components. And on the other hand, there are plenty of open questions for the full shift on three symbols. So on the lectures on the Wednesday, I will probably show the theorem on heteroclinic connection, give some idea, and then explain some idea, some phenomena which is known as heteroclinic bifurcation, which is this accumulation of infinite number of components over some components of over some fixed component and accumulation of distinct components. Some phenomena which is really different for product of three matrices with relation with product of two matrices. Okay, thank you.